Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to speak about in my view, of course, of the essence of Hanukkah. And there are a number of questions that we must ask right at the inception. First of all, why is Hanukkah a holiday? After all, we stop the story in midstream, and the story goes on to have a quite bitter end. The five sons of Matisyahu are either all killed or assassinated in the course of the Book of Maccabees 1. And we stop the story at the end of Maccabees chapter 4. And we don't go on with the rest of the story. In fact, in Jewish history, we wouldn't even know the names of the five sons of Matisyahu because that was preserved in the Book of Maccabees, which is not considered Kitvei HaKodesh. It was not included in the canon. And therefore, it was basically lost into Jewish history. The church preserved it in Greek, and then it was retranslated relatively in modern times back into Hebrew, but we did not preserve the Book of Maccabees. So without the Book of Maccabees, we wouldn't know the sons of Matisyahu, except for Josephus, who brought it out from the Book of Maccabees. But Josephus himself is considered a traitor by our people, and his books too were not preserved. So as far as the Jewish people are concerned, we would not know of the heroes of the Maccabees, the wars of the Maccabees. Anything that happened after chapter 4 in the Book of Maccabees would be totally unknown to us. So what is this kind of a story that we stop in midstream? Why do we stop in midstream? And why do we celebrate a holiday that has basically a very tragic ending for all the five sons of the Maccabees get killed? The Ramban in Parshas Vayechi goes on to say that why did the Maccabees suffer such a terrible fate that they were all killed or they became tzedukim was because they usurped the malchus. They took upon themselves as Kohanim priests. They took upon themselves to be the kings of Israel, which is in the view of the Ramban, a violation of the last will and testament of Yaakov Avinu, Tzavos HaZaken. And as a result of that, they either were killed or they became tzedukim or they had a terrible fate. So again, we're looking at a story that we cut short, and we're super critical, at least the Ramban is, of what the Kashrim accomplished or what they did, except for the fact that they liberated the temple. So let's take a look at this piece about liberating the temple. So we all know that they liberated the temple and they scoured the temple environs to find a jug of oil that had the imprimatur of the Kohen Gadol of the high priest. That means it was not defiled by the Greeks, the pagan idolaters. The question that we must ask is, this celebration of Hanukkah is a Hanukkah's HaMizbeach. It's not a celebration of the menorah. It's a celebration of the dedication of the temple, the cleansing of the temple, and the resumption of the temple service that happened on the 25th day of Kislev, although that's also problematic, but I'm not getting into that. But on the 25th day of Kislev, in our tradition, the temple was cleansed and the service was recommenced. How was the service recommenced? The priests were the leaders of the revolt. The priests were the soldiers. The priests are the ones that fought. They were Tamei Meis. They were defiled by dead, by the dead of the Jewish soldiers who they buried or the dead of their comrades in arms who fell next to them. They were Tamei. So how could they restart the sacrificial rite in the temple when they were Tamei? What do we say to that? We say Tumah Hutra B'Tzibur, that when the community, when the Rabbim is Tamei, the laws of Tumah are suspended, which is a very pragmatic halacha, because there's no way to rejuvenate if everybody's Tumah. How do you resurrect and create a status of non-Tumah? Answer is you don't have to bother with that Tumah Hutra B'Tzibur or even Dechuya B'Tzibur. Either it's pushed aside or it's absolutely abolished. So therefore, the Kohanim could serve and rededicate the service in the temple. If that's the case, then why did they need pure oil? Tumah Hutra B'Tzibur, the oil itself could be used even if it was contaminated. So what is this business about? We celebrate the holiday of Hanukkah because they found pure oil. They didn't need to look for pure oil. They didn't need pure oil. And so what is going on? Okay. We'll ask some more questions. In the second chapter of the Book of Maccabees, there's an amazing story told. After Matisyahu starts the revolt in the little village of Modi'in. 1,000 people, you know, Kohanim or mixed people, not necessarily Kohanim, 1,000 people leave Jerusalem and they go into the deserts and they hide in the caves, probably around Qumran over there near Masada, whatever. They're hiding in the caves. And the Greek authorities, the Greco-Syrian authorities, pursue them. And they come upon this cave where they're hiding on Shabbos. And they decide, the Gentiles decide to attack on Shabbos, and the inhabitants of this cave, even though it had superior defensive position, where they could kill whoever repelled down, or they could shoot at whoever was trying to ascend to the cave, they refused to fight on Shabbos. On the Sabbath day, they refused to fight, and they were slaughtered, man, woman, children, the entire community was wiped out by the enemy. This news reaches Matisyahu's camp, and he calls a council of his men, and he says, we cannot do this anymore, because if we refuse to fight on Shabbos, the enemy will constantly attack us on Shabbos and will be wiped out. So from henceforth, we are no longer going to lay down our arms. If they attack us on Shabbos, we're going to fight on Shabbos. This creates a great problem for rabbinic Judaism, because we believe v'chai b'hem, the pasuk in the Torah that tells us that for all of the mitzvahs of the Torah, one should violate them and not forfeit his life except for the three cardinal principles. This fighting on Shabbos is not a cardinal principle. So we would say that the tradition all the way back to Sinai was v'chai b'hem, that you live by these laws and you do not die by these laws. So if that's the case, how come they didn't know this halacha? How come they laid down their lives and they didn't fight on the Shabbos? And why did Matisyahu have to say, we're not going to do this any longer? It's a big question on rabbinic Judaism. Okay. By the way, how did they even kindle the menorah? Let's assume they found pure oil. And, of course, we believe that. Let's assume they put the pure oil into the menorah. Who lit the menorah? The Kohanim. The Kohanim lit the menorah. They were Tameh. And if you waited 7 days until they purified themselves, you could find a new source of oil. They didn't have to rely on the miracle. And that's another question. How could they start before they were ready to go forward? In other words, if you take a look at Moshe, when he consecrated the Mishkan, Vayhi Kechalos Moshe, when Moshe finished all of the work that was necessary for the completion of the mitzvah, of the Mishkan, for the commencement of the sacrificial rites in the Mishkan, he didn't do it halfway. He didn't start when he would have a break. So what did they think? They put oil in the menorah. They didn't know it was going to burn for 8 days. So what were they doing? They started without having everything in place. When Shlomo finished the Beis HaMikdash, he did not start until everything was in place. Why didn't they wait till everything was in place? Why did they start to light the menorah when they least conceivably thought they would have to stop after 1 day because they didn't have any more pure oil? Okay, another question. I may not have enough time to answer these questions because I usually take an hour and 20 minutes for this lecture, but I'm just going to go on. Okay. Why
Pesach,
is the
after period, Pesach we'll answer them. Okay.
Okay, so that's good. Why is the period of the hegemony of the Greeks called Golos Yavon? After all, Galut means exile. The children of Israel were not exiled at this time. They were in the land of Israel. Why is it then referred to as a Galut? Okay, a little question. Then another question. How was it that the Greek culture and the values gained penetration and entree into the mindset of the Jews? I heard the prior speaker mention this a little bit, but what happens here is that the majority of the Jewish people at the time of the Nes of Hanukkah were Hellenists. The Greek culture had so permeated the Jewish culture, the Jewish civilization, that the majority of our people were Hellenists. This never happened before, that a Gentile culture should take over control of our people's mindset. Okay. Well, let's get to some of the answers maybe now. Well, we need to put this whole holiday into context. Historians have written, and it is definitely true, that the conflict between, let's call it the Greek civilization and the Jewish civilization, the Torah civilization, is what gave rise to Western culture. The Greeks introduced, astronomy and architecture and drama and art and music, all these things that the Greeks were so advanced with. That's the Greek culture. And the Jews introduced morality, morals, charity, righteousness, justice, into the pot, let's call it. And from that pot emerged Western civilization. Our tradition starts this conflict with a story of the great Shimon HaTzadik, who, when Alexander the Great arrived or approached the gates of Jerusalem, went out in full garb of the Kohen Gadol, which he was, and he went out to greet Alexander the Great, and Alexander the Great dismounted, etc., etc. The whole story is, well, there's a whole question of the story, what really happened, but this is the point where the two cultures came into conflict. When Alexander the Great began his conquest and he came to Judea, that's when the conflict between the Judaism and the Greek culture arose. The Mishnah, the Talmud Bavli, tells us in Masechtas Megillah that Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says that a Sefer Torah could be written in ancient Greek, and it could be read in the synagogue on Shabbos, and seven Jews could be called up for Aliyahs, and they could make the blessing on the Greek Sefer Torah. This is how much respect our sages of the Mishnaic period had for the Greek culture. They had, when it says Chochma Bagoyim Tamin in the Mishnah in Avot, when it tells us that we should believe that there is great wisdom amongst the Gentiles, the Mishnah is referring to the wisdom of the Greeks. And this Greek wisdom floored the Jews. They never encountered such a profound, deep, philosophic enemy that they could, they had to contest with, that they had to deal with. This was the ability of the Greek culture to penetrate into the Jewish mindset, because we, the Jews, appreciated wisdom, we appreciated knowledge, and when we came across, or when we came into contact with the Greek wisdom, we were overwhelmed by that Greek wisdom. What happened? Along with this Greek wisdom came the worship of the body, the worship of beauty, the Colosseums, the gladiators, the fights, between men and animal in the public spectre, where everybody cheering and putting, cheering on the animals to kill the people, or the people to kill the animals, whatever it was. All of this was a byproduct of the Greek culture, very invested in the Greek culture. When the rabbis realized that along with the wisdom of the Greek culture came these dangers to our moral structure, they decided to ban the Greek language. They banned the Greek books that were called Sefer Chitzonios. They began to get very, very meticulous and careful as to what they would consider part of the canon, what they wouldn't consider part of the canon, because they were looking to expunge any influences. And the Book of Maccabees was probably the result that the Book of Maccabees was not included in the canon was probably because there was elements of Greek culture that crept into it, like the prior speaker said. And so there was a battle now drawn. That was the Jews' reaction. They had to stamp out the Greek culture penetrating into the Jewish people, and they took extreme measures to vitiate the Greek culture, remove it, expunge it from Judaism. The other hand, the Greeks, they came across the Jews. Every nation they conquered, the victims, the conquered nation would adopt the gods of the Greeks, because they used to think that if my God was as powerful as your God, then we wouldn't have been conquered. We wouldn't have been vanquished. If we're conquered, it's because the Greek gods are superior to our gods. Here comes the Greeks into Judea. They conquer the Jews. And the reaction is not only is your gods not superior to our gods. Your gods have no essence. They're nothing. It's all a bunch of wood and stone. There is no essence to your idols. There's nothing. And we are telling them, you are murderers. You rape. You kill. You steal. You plunder. You do all these terrible things. How do you adjust to that? How do you live with yourselves? And so the Greeks now are reeling, reeling, R-E-E-L-I-N-G, reeling from their encounter with the Jews. So what's happening here? This is the battle. The lines of war are drawn. The lines of battle are drawn. And it all comes to a head in the holiday of Hanukkah, in the events of the holiday of Hanukkah. Okay. So now we have a royal battle raging. Let's take these. The way that the Hashmonaim waged war was a way of zealotry. Kanoz. They were Kanoim. How do we know they were Kanoim? Because if you read in the book of Maccabees, when the Greco-Syrians came to Modin, and they offered Mattathiahu the opportunity, the great honor of bringing a pig on an altar to their gods, he said no. He refused. He turned down their offer. So another Jew who was in the crowd raced forward because they promised, reward if you would do this. He raced forward, and what he did was he went up to offer the sacrifice. And Mattathiahu takes out a sword and slays the Jew on the spot. And the way the book of Maccabees puts it is, Vayikane Mattathiahu kimpinchas aviv. The book of Maccabees draws the parallel between what Pinchas did to Zimri and Cosby in Parshas Chukas and then to Pinchas. What did he do? He slew them on the spot. There was no due process. There was no warning, no hasra, no court procedure. It was an act of zealotry, and that's what Mattathiahu did himself. And what did he call out? Mi l'Hashem Eli. Who is to God? Follow me. The same thing that Moshe Rabbeinu called out when he adjured the tribe of Levi to slay all of those who had a part in the Cheta Egel, in the sin of the Egel. So this is a matter of kanois, of zealotry. That is why the 1,000 people who went into the caves would not fight on Shabbos. One of the laws that the Romans passed was that one of the edicts that they enacted was that the Jews could not keep Shabbos. So these Jews said, we are not going to allow this infidel nation, this pagan idolatrous nation, to steal our Shabbos from us. We'll die, and we will not violate the Shabbos. Oh yes, halachically we could fight. But we will not allow this conqueror, this pagan, pagan idolatrous nation to force us to violate our Shabbos. We will rather die than violate the Shabbos. That is an act of kanoz. I'll tell you, Elazar, the son of one of the 5 sons, commits basically suicide. He stabs the underbelly of an elephant, which he thinks the general is riding in, and the elephant falls upon him, crushes him to death, and kills the people that were in the elephant. Unfortunately, it was not the general, but basically his act was an act of kanoz. It was an act of zealotry. The story in the book of Maccabees of how Yehuda HaMaccabee dies is the final, I would say, peg in the hole that completes the proof that this was a kanoz, this was a revolt of zealotry. Yehuda HaMaccabee defeats Nicanor, he defeats Demetrius, he defeats all kinds of armies, tens of thousands, a lot of soldiers who come into Judea from Antioch. He encounters them, he defeats them one after another, and he left after he cleanses the country of all the Greco-Syrian army. He stays and remains with a force of 3,000 men. And the Antiochus, the Epiphanes III or whatever, sends down another army with 20,000 men. And the soldiers in Yehuda HaMaccabee's camp say to their leader, let us fade into the countryside. Each of us go home to his village. Each of us bring back men from our villages, and let's raise an army that will be somewhat equal to the force that is arrayed against us. And Yehuda HaMaccabee says, no. It will never be said that Yehuda HaMaccabee turned his back on and fled in the face of the enemy. I'm going to stand my ground. Well, 2,200 of his 3,000 men thought that was suicide, and they left. He's now left with 800 men from his 3,000. He's facing a force of 20,000 men, battle elephants, all kinds of things. And the men say to him now, listen, general, we need to fade into the background and go back to our villages like our peers did. And we need to reassemble in the spring when we can raise an army. Says Yehuda to them the same thing. It will never be said that Yehuda HaMaccabee fled from the enemy and turned his back and ran from the battlefield. And so the 800 men engaged the 20,000 men. They were surrounded, and the way the Book of Maccabees portrays it is that the earth shook from the din of the battle, but in the end, Yehuda was killed and his men were destroyed. His army was destroyed. This is how he died. He fought like a zealot. He died like a zealot. He and his family were zealots. And that explains why they wouldn't fight on Shabbos. It also explains why they usurped the Malchus. Remember now, the Ramban said that when they usurped the Malchus, they violated the decree of Yaakov, of the Tzavos HaZaken, the last testament of Yaakov Avinu. They said to themselves, there is no one else that can pick up the mantle of leadership except us. We stepped forward. We put our life on the line. We raised an army. We fought the enemy. We rid the enemy of the Greco-Syrian armies out of Israel at the end of the story. And therefore, we have the right to be the kings. We are the only ones who can serve in that function, because in a matter of zealotry, there is Eis Lasos Lashem Heferu Serasecha. There comes a time when the situation demands a violation of the Torah itself. That's how the Talmud Bavli and Yerushalmi got written down. Because there came a time, because of the oppression of the enemy and the scattering of our people, etc., all this dislocation, that the rabbis decided to write down the oral law, even though it was prohibited. Why? Because Eis Lasot Lashem Heferu Torasecha. Said the Chashmonaim, Eis Lasot Lashem Heferu Torasecha. We need to become the kings. And therefore, they took upon themselves the function of a king, even though a plain, ordinary Jew is not allowed to become the king, and for sure not a Kohen. The Kohanim were not allowed to become kings. Okay, but that's what they did. They became kings because they were afraid that there was no one else to step into the void. Now, this also gives us understanding of how the Chashanayim fought with such a zealous intensity that they stunned the Greco-Syrian army. It's almost galahavdil. I mean, like when Hamas attacks us and we are not ready to, you know, the intensity of their attacks were so vicious and so cruel and so, you know, blind by their hatred and their zealotry that it is very difficult to defend against them. And we suffered many casualties on the early days of the war because of the ferocity of what they did. So too, I hate to make that comparison, but that's really what it is in the real world. So too, the fierceness and unparalleled ferocity of the Chashanayim was spurned and instigated by their zealotry. Okay. So let's go back to see what we asked about the questions. This is a story of Kanois. Let's talk about what the Ramban says. The Ramban says that ultimately they became Sadducees. How can we understand? How does the Ramban put it? He says, these imole, if not for these holy Jews, nishtaka ha-Torah v'ha-mitzvahs mi-Yisrael. The Torah and all of the mitzvahs would have been forgotten in Israel. If it not for the zealotry of the Chashanoim, there would be nothing left of our faith. And yet they become Sadukim, they become Sadducees. How does this understand? How can you understand this? when I suggest that when you adopt zealotry and you make that your mantra and you make that your reason d'etre, and that becomes your motivating factor and that's what governs your life, you step outside of the ordinary boundaries of halacha. And when you step out of the ordinary boundaries of halacha, and you do it one time, two times, 10 times, one generation, two generations, three generations, it breeds disrespect for the halacha. It causes you yourself to not have respect for what you're supposed to be upholding. In fact, is I'm going to be so bold as to say that, in our days, we feel sometimes, maybe rightfully, maybe not rightfully, but sometimes we feel, what is happening in our Orthodox world? There is chumras and more chumras and more chumras and this and that. Everything becomes usher. I used to say that that the current rabbinical leadership of our people is bent on sapping all joy from life. As soon as something becomes pleasurable, lo and behold, it becomes usher. So therefore, what happens is we ourselves, and I'm talking about B'nai Torah, we ourselves, in our hearts or among ourselves in close quarters, we begin to wonder, what in the world is happening? Why are they heaping chumra upon chumra? What is, it's like religion gone berserk, and we don't understand it. This is what happens when you let zealotry or chumra govern your lifestyle. If it becomes the mantra of your lifestyle, it breeds disrespect for the rabbis. Unfortunately, it breeds disrespect for the Torah. And that's what happened with the Chashmonaim. They stepped outside of the parameters of halacha. They believed they were above it, and they didn't have to come to deal with it because they invoked Eit Lasos Lashem Heferu Torasecha, and as a result, ultimately, they became Sadducees. And therefore, when I told my dear cousin Jay, who, unbelievable what he does for spreading Jewish knowledge in not just in Toronto, but in the whole world. I applaud him for that. When I said that I forget what I entitled my speech, something about the light of the Hanukkah continuing to burn or something like that.
The eternal light.
The internal light of Hanukkah. The eternal light of Hanukkah is to teach us that we need to learn to rein in. To rein in the chumrah madness. And so that we restore respect for halacha. And if we don't restore respect for halacha, okay, there is going to be a whole segment of what we might call kanoim. I don't even want to brand which part of our people are in that camp, but we know who we're talking about. And those kind of people, we can't share words with them. We wonder what in the world's going on. What in the world is going on? It's a tremendous thing. I'll give you an example. We are now in a great war for the very existence of the state of Israel. And we all appreciate that. Why don't we declare a national fast day like Esther did? Why don't we get all the Haredim and all the Admorim and all the Rosh Yeshivas and all the rabbis to get together and declare a Tanit Tzibur that we should pray and study and beg God to bring salvation to our people? You know what the answer to that is? We have no words to speak to each other. There's no avenues or lines of communication. Very, very few of them, of us, talk to each other. We are basically cut off. This is we know from the Megillah, that when Esther said, when Mordechai tells Esther, go into the king, she says, no, first, Lech Kenosis Kol Yehudim, unite the Jewish people, Vitzamu Alai, and declare a fast day. Why don't we do that today? Because we cannot get together. This is not something that, is a bolt of lightning out of the Shemayim. This is something that should be done, almost a knee-jerk reaction. This is what we do. We fast, we pray. But no, nobody's thinking of it. Nobody's doing it because to accomplish it is impossible. It would only sow more discord. And therefore, nobody tries to do it. That is the lesson of Hanukkah. Please don't go down that line, says the story of Hanukkah. For if you go down that line, you become a Sadducee. You lose respect for the Torah. And that's what happened to the Hashmonaim. So while we applaud their victory, and while we applaud their defense of Judaism, and while we applaud what they did to rid the country of this enemy and restore Torah values, we also bemoan the fact and we stop the story. We don't complete the story. The Mishnah doesn't mention the story. Why doesn't the Mishnah mention the story? Because the story doesn't have a happy ending. Not only because of the death of the sons of Matisyahu, but because of the despoiling of the Hashmonaim themselves, they become Sadducees. The story has a very, very unhappy ending, and we stop the story. We never complete the story. We didn't even perpetuate it in our tradition. It's not part of our holy text. If it wasn't for the church, we wouldn't even know it. And that's the truth of the matter. And that's the final message of Hanukkah, is that it needs to burn eternally, because it needs to teach us that unbridled chumras and unbridled zealotry will lead to disaster. The final message.
Yeah. Thank you. You're getting a lot of pushback on your. I always love your openness, of course, in the way you experience, you know, for sure, you know, really, really. But you're getting a lot of pushback on the fact that there's no fasting, although I tend to agree with you more. That yes, this one fast. Yeah, there were fast days. The OU had a fast day. This one, Yom Kippur. But that's the problem. Nobody knows about it. There hasn't been a.
I'm talking about everybody getting together, where there'd be a million Jews, everybody getting together and saying we're going to fast on this and this day, and all of the rabbis proclaim it as a Tanis Sibor, and it's mandatory. And nobody did that.
Yeah. Okay. I hear you. This was the Aguda did this. Hadar did this. The OU did it. But I guess that's the point.
Got together.
I'm with you.
What did Esther say? Leich kenois es kol ha'yehudim mitzom mu'alai.
But rabbis, there's a different issue. Even individually, if each individual yeshiva head rabbi acknowledges that what we're going through now is a mechemet mitzvah, that imposes on them a course of action that they don't have to consult anybody else with. They don't have to take money from the state. Their people should be fighting in some way, supportive or not, if they consider it a mechemet mitzvah.
Yeah, we're going to make this quick.
By the definition of the Rambam, whenever an enemy attacks the Jewish people, it's a mechemet mitzvah. And what is the din on a mechemet mitzvah? Hakol yotzim. Everybody must fight. Afilu chosen michupasa v'chala michupasa. Even take the bride right and the chosen out from under the canopy and put them on the front lines. Everybody has to fight, or everybody has to contribute to the war effort. Why they don't do it? Don't ask me.
That has actually happened in some circles. I know of weddings where in Israel taking place and before the Shavuot brachas were over, they were back on the front lines.
Is not the Haredim.
Yeah,
the
of course. Haredim, no, that's obvious. No, yes.
The Haredim, yes. I'm telling you, I don't want to even talk about it because
yes,
it's too
upsetting. I agree. Yes, yes. So
very upsetting to me, the Haredim's reaction to this war.
Yeah, that's a different story, not for now. I agree. There is tremendous unity, but what Rabbi Kowalski Avram is saying is that there's room for more. That's how I think I will summarize. There's been a tremendous growth in unity, which is wonderful,
yes,
but we're not there yet. We're not
tremendous unity amongst the people of Israel, exclusive of the Haredim.
Okay. All right, Rabbi Avram, thank you. Always interesting and insightful. And we want to hear the longer version of some of the answers to the questions. But the questions, as we know from Pesach, are more important than answers.